Okay, first we do homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Maybe we could put over there. Okay. Good evening, everybody. Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't come last month, but you know what happened just the day before? Was it the day before I was to come? I found out that my email address had been hijacked and somebody had been using it to send out emails to many people on my contact list, maybe most of them, telling them that I suddenly had to attend a seminar in Scotland and I had lost my wallet and credit cards and I had a hotel bill of £2,800, which is $3,200, you know, a seminar for probably at the most four nights. So I stay at hotels that cost $800 a night. So saying, please, can you help me by sending me some money through Western Union, and I'll be happy to pay it back the first opportunity. But I got my revenge on him. After I reported to Google, and then they temporarily closed down my Gmail account, I found out that what he had done very cleverly was to open a new account using the name Venerable Bode Lee with an L put into my name at gmail.com, hoping that people wouldn't notice if you just look at the address quickly and superficially without paying close attention, you don't notice that there's an L inserted between the D and the H. And so some of my friends were thinking that the hijacker is still using my email account. But I noticed this, and what I did was to open up a Gmail account under a pseudonym, an ordinary name. And then I wrote an email to Venerable Bodhi saying, "Dear Bhante, how are you doing? How's your health?" And because he had programmed emails coming to Venerable Bodhi to get forwarded to Venerable Bode Lee, so my email got forwarded to him. Then he replied to me with my civilian name, "Dear Teddy," I use the name Teddy, Teddy Bear, B-A-I-R. So he wrote back, "Dear Teddy, you know, I've been stranded here in Scotland at a hotel, and I have to pay my hotel bills. Can you send me some money? I really need it urgently." So then I wrote back to him. I said, "Well, Bhante, I'm really amazed that you get around so quickly. But I'm glad that you're getting to do some teaching overseas. You know, I don't get paid until Friday, but I'll speak to my wife tomorrow and ask if she has any money to spare." Then he wrote back to me and said, "Dear Teddy, thank you so much for being willing to help me out. I really appreciate it, but please get the money to me as quickly as possible." So then the next day I wrote to him and I said, "Dear Bhante, I'm sorry I have to tell you this, but my wife had to leave very quickly today to attend a special conference in the Midwest. And I don't think that she'll have the time to stop at a Western Union office to wire the money to you. But I just thought of something, a good suggestion to make to you. Why don't you call the Sri Lankan Buddhist temple in Glasgow? He wrote that he was in Edinburgh, Scotland. So I said, why don't you call the Sri Lankan Buddhist temple in Glasgow? I don't have the phone number, but I'm sure if you make some inquiries, you'll be able to find it. I hear that the chief monk of the Sri Lankan temple, Venerable Sirima Bandara Nayaka Taro, is a very, very kind and generous monk who would be very happy to help you out in your time of difficulty. Okay, I didn't get a reply from him. Wait, but then I decided to write to him later that day. I said, Dear Bhante, I have some great news for you. I just contacted Venerable Sirima Bandara Nayaka Taro at the Sri Lankan temple in Glasgow, and he was really surprised to hear that you're in Scotland now. And he said that he and the monks from the Vihara, together with a group of their lay devotees, are eager to come out to Edinburgh tomorrow to see you. The lay devotees are willing to cover all of your hotel bills and all of your other expenses, so don't worry. But we have to know what hotel you're staying in. And if you have any telephone number where we could contact you, please let me know. And then I only got a one-line response from him 3 minutes later saying, DUMB, dumb, the letter U, Bhante. Dumb you, Bhante. I think he might have wanted to say, damn you, Bhante. And then I never heard from him afterwards. Okay, but if any of you get an email from anybody using my name, soliciting money, telling you a sob story, please don't believe it. Because I checked fairly recently, just before we went on our 10-day retreat, I checked with using the Gmail to set up an account. I checked to see whether the account name Ven Bode Lee is still active, and it's still active, even though I reported to Google that somebody was using this address in order to solicit funds in my name, but they didn't close it down. Okay, so today we will be taking Sutta number 78 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called Samana Mandika Sutta, and this is starting on page 648. Okay, so the sutta begins at a time when a certain wanderer, his name is given here is Ugahamana Samana Pundika, I'm sorry, Samana Mandika Putta. We don't hear of him, to my knowledge, to my recollection, any place else in the Sutta Pitaka, only in the Sutta. He was staying at a place called Malika's Park. This was probably built by Queen Malika. Malika was the wife of King Pasenadi of Kosala. It's called the Malika's Park, the single hall Tinduka plantation for philosophical debates. Apparently, the Queen Malika had built this park with one hall, a residential hall in it, in order for the different groups of wanderers and philosophers and ascetics who were passing through the city of Savatthi, to stay there and to hold their debates about their respective doctrines. And so he's staying there. He's apparently the leader of a group of wanderers, so he has a large following, as many as about 300 disciple wanderers. Okay, then one day, a carpenter by the name of Panchakanga, this carpenter was the personal carpenter of King Pasenadi, and he was also a lay disciple of the Buddha. So the carpenter was going out from Savatthi in the middle of the day in order to visit the Buddha. And in the middle of the day, it's considered not the proper time to visit monasteries, because the monks, after taking their meal, they're usually resting. And so he thought that this is not the right time to see the Blessed One or to see the monks. So let me go to Malika's Park and visit this wanderer, Ugahamana Samana Mandika Putta. And so he goes there, and then when he approaches, the wanderer is seated in the large assembly of wanderers, and they were talking noisily, making an uproar about many kinds of pointless talk. If you remember, we came across the same passage earlier when we discussed Sutta number 76 that gives the full list of the pointless topics that they were discussing. And sometimes it seems to me that this is a way, I have to say, that the compilers of the Buddhist text ridicule or mock the wanderers of other sects. They always show them to be engaged in discussions about pointless topics. But to speak very frankly, if you were to maybe you learned the trick of becoming invisible, and you visited an ordinary monastery in Sri Lanka, Thailand, maybe Burma, at some time in the middle of the day, and found a group of monks sitting around chatting. Think, what are they talking about? Some deep points of Dhamma, about meditation realizations, about higher Buddhist philosophy. Creep up. Maybe Sri Lanka. Do you think our team is going to win the cricket tournament this week? The Australian team is pretty tough. Or who do you think is going to win the parliamentary election from our district? Is it the UNP? No, I think the SLFP candidate is really going to knock him to the ground this time. Okay, so it seems to be a typical of human nature to engage and talk about these pointless topics rather than on, you know, deep Dhamma. Okay, so when the wanderer sees the carpenter approaching in the distance, then he turns to his own followers and he says, "Please be quiet. Please make no noise. Here comes the carpenter Panchakanga, a disciple of the ascetic Gotama. He's one of the ascetic Gotama's white-robed lay disciples living at Savatthi." Then he says, "These venerable ones like quiet. They are disciplined and quiet. They command quiet." If you remember last time, I said, if you think this is still true today, don't go to Sri Lanka on an Uposatha today. When all of the loudspeakers are turned on, isn't that so? And you get from every direction, "Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato." Okay, so he says, "Perhaps if he finds our assembly a quiet one, he will think to join us." Okay, so the wanderers become silent. Then the carpenter goes up to them, and, they exchange some courtesies. Then when they sit down, then the wanderer, Ugahamana, says to him, "Okay, when a man possesses four qualities, I describe him as accomplished in what is wholesome, that is, in what is kusala, perfected in what is wholesome, an ascetic invincible, an unconquerable ascetic who has attained to the supreme attainment. Okay, so this is now he's going to explain his ideal of the supreme ascetic. This would be a counterpart to the arahant in the early Buddhist conception of the perfected individual. So now he gives his, he describes the four qualities. Here he does no evil bodily actions. He utters no evil speech. He has no evil intentions. And he does not earn his living by an evil or wrong livelihood. When a man possesses these four qualities, I describe him as accomplished in what is wholesome, and so forth. Okay, now this is quite typical when a disciple of the Buddha encounters wanderers of other sects and hears them make some statement, and the disciple is not quite able on his own to evaluate the truth or the value of the statement of the wanderer of the other sect. So he doesn't show agreement with it. He doesn't start disputing and arguing with the wanderer. That would be maybe impolite, disrespectful, bad taste. And also he might feel that he doesn't have the qualifications for doing this. And so he just probably after a little further polite discussion, then he gets up and goes away thinking, I will ask the Buddha about this, find out how the Buddha, what the Buddha thinks of this statement. Okay, so then he goes to the presence of the Buddha and he tells the Buddha what he's heard from the wanderer Ugahamana. And then the Buddha says, he now uses a simile to show the defect in this wanderer's position. He says, if that were so, carpenter, then a young, tender infant lying on his back would be accomplished in what is wholesome, perfected in what is wholesome, an ascetic invincible, attained to the supreme attainment. For a young, tender infant does not even have the idea body, so he doesn't do any bad bodily actions except wriggling. He doesn't even have the idea speech, and so he doesn't utter any evil speech. He just whines or cries. And he doesn't even have the idea intention, and so he doesn't have any bad intentions. He just sulks. And then he doesn't even have the idea of livelihood. And so how could he earn his living by a wrong livelihood? All he does to sustain himself is to drink the milk from his mother's breast. Okay, so if the wanderer's statement were true, were acceptable, were valid, then it would follow that this young newborn infant would be a supreme ascetic. Okay, now if we look at these statements that the wanderer Ugahamana makes, can we see any correspondence? He mentions four qualities. Correspondence between these particular factors and any formulation within the Buddha's teaching? Exactly. Who said that? Okay, very, very good. We could see in them correspondence between four factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. These would be the factors of, naturally, of right speech, right action, right livelihood, and right intentions. But now, if we look at the way the Buddha describes the action of a disciple who's undertaken the training, we see that the Buddha doesn't state simply that he does no evil bodily actions, does no evil speech, has no evil intentions, does not earn his living by a wrong livelihood. But the Buddha phrases it somewhat differently. Do you remember how the Buddha would phrase this type of behavior? I think this would indicate an important difference between the Buddha's perspective and what is implied or suggested by the statement of the wanderer, Ugahamana. Exactly, exactly. Very good. The Buddha always phrases the behavior of the disciple in terms of abstaining, abandoning and abstaining. So, for example, if one looks, Sutta number 41 would be an example. Well, let us take the path factor, Sutta 141. Yeah, this is will be exactly a page 1100. If you look at what is right speech, okay, then abstaining from false speech, abstaining from malicious speech, and so on. Then what is right action? Abstaining from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from misconduct and sensual pleasures. What is right livelihood? The noble disciple, having abandoned wrong livelihood, earns his living by right livelihood. So we have this explained in terms of abstaining and abandoning. And then in Sutta number 41, this is on page 382, just to take one example, in paragraph 12, three kinds of bodily conduct in accordance with the Dhamma. Here, someone abandoning the killing of living beings abstains from killing living beings. Then having abandoning the taking what is not given, he abstains from taking what is not given, and so on. And then similarly, in the case of speech, and so these words, abstaining, abandoning, and abstaining, first of all, indicate that here some kind of intention or volition is involved. One is undertaking or making the resolution to abstain from these unwholesome actions, to abstain from unwholesome speech, to avoid a wrong livelihood. And so that implies some kind of training, a kind of spiritual training that one is undergoing. In the case of intention, it's not as obvious, since right intention on page 1100, it's defined as intention of renunciation or desirelessness, intention of non-ill will, intention of non-cruelty. But these are intentions, purposes, or motivations which go against sensuality, against ill will, against cruelty or the harming of living beings. And so again, forming these intentions is a kind of spiritual training which is directly opposed to the harmful intentions. So it's not simply not doing any evil, but it's forming the intention to go against what is unwholesome, against what is evil, and then abandoning the unwholesome courses and actually taking up the wholesome courses of conduct. Okay, and also the statement, as we'll see, of the Ugahamana deals only with aspects of training which cover intention and actions. They don't really deal with the higher mental training at all. Okay, so now the Buddha continues and says, when a man possesses these four qualities, that is of that ascetic, of that wanderer, I describe him not as accomplished in what is wholesome, not as the supreme ascetic, but as one who stands at the same level as the young, tender infant lying on its back. And then the Buddha just repeats the same four qualities mentioned by the wanderer, Ugahamana. Okay, now the Buddha here first lays out what he regards as the 10 qualities that make a person accomplished in what is wholesome, attain to the supreme attainment. Oh, he mentions that there are 10 qualities, but he doesn't enumerate them at once. But now he's going to go into a finer analysis of different types of unwholesome qualities, wholesome qualities, and then where they cease completely. Okay, so now the text says, I say it must be understood thus, and I think either myself or maybe Bhikkhunyana Moli added these words, but first of all, I say it must be understood thus. And then the Buddha lays out a kind of, we call this a matika, that is like an outline of things that he's going to analyze, and then he will analyze them. Okay, so it must be understood, these are unwholesome habits, and I'll come back to that word in a moment, and thus, unwholesome habits originate from this, and thus, unwholesome habits cease without remainder here, and thus, one practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of unwholesome habits. Then it must be understood, these are wholesome habits. Wholesome habits originate from this. Wholesome habits cease without remainder here. And then one practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of wholesome habits. Okay, then basically the same scheme is laid out with regard to intentions. These are unwholesome intentions. Unwholesome intentions originate from this. Unwholesome intention cease without remainder here, and thus one practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of unwholesome intentions, and it must be understood thus. These are wholesome intentions, then wholesome intentions originate from this. Wholesome intention cease without remainder here, and one practicing in this way is practicing the way to the cessation of wholesome intentions. So that is the matika, the outline, the call it the table of contents for the analysis. And now we come to the analysis itself. But first, I want to deal with the question, when the wanderer Ugahamana speaks of four qualities, but now the Buddha seemingly has reduced them to two. What one is habits and the other are intentions. Now, maybe a key to understanding what's going on is if we take the actual Pali word that's translated as habits, and it's the word sila. I mean, you all know it, but I'll write it anyway. Or it's actually... Okay, here it's occurring in the plural form. The plural would be silani. Now the word sila originally meant simply behavior. That's the kind of fundamental sense. But in the Buddhist teaching, it is usually used with the sense of virtuous behavior, virtuous conduct, or wholesome behavior, wholesome conduct. But here, in this passage, we have a contrast between wholesome sila and unwholesome sila. So in that case, we have to understand sila in the older, original sense, simply of habits or behavior patterns. So the wholesome sila would be what we normally mean by sila, virtuous behavior. And of course, there's no such thing as unwholesome virtuous behavior. So we have to understand unwholesome sila to be simply unwholesome behavior, unwholesome actions. And so within the category of sila, we have the three other factors besides intention mentioned by the wanderer. That is, within sila, we have, or silani, we have bodily action, verbal action or speech, and the livelihood. Okay, so first, now we come to the analysis or elaboration with section number 10. What are unwholesome habits? They are unwholesome bodily actions, unwholesome verbal actions, and evil or wrong livelihood. These are called unwholesome habits. Okay, then the question comes, what do these unwholesome habits originate from? Okay, their origin is stated, in other words, the Buddha explains their origin, and they should be said to originate from the mind. In Pali, this is citta. Okay, so this is quite an important point that we come across again and again in the Buddha's teaching, different ways, and that is that bodily actions, verbal actions, originate from the mind. This is why the Buddha makes the mind the focal point of his training. And it seems that the wanderer, Ugaha, let's say the wanderer, that wandering ascetic, didn't really touch on the mind very much at all. Maybe he just lightly touched on it with the word sankappa, intention. But he didn't get to the root of the matter, which is citta. The mind is the source of intentions. And so we find, for example, in the famous first two verses of Dhammapada, mano pubhangama dhamma, mano setta, mano maya, manasa cha badutena bhasati va karoti va tatonang dukkam anveti chakangva vahato padang. Whatever dhammas there are, mind is the forerunner, mind is supreme. They are all made by the mind. If one speaks or acts with a corrupted mind, then suffering follows afterwards, just as the wheel follows the foot of the ox. In those verses, the word used is mano rather than citta, but basically the sense is the same. Did you have a question? Oh, that's the first. It's the first verse of the Dhammapada. Oh. Dhammapada, verse 1. Okay, so mind is the origin of unwholesome behavior, but what kind of mind? Then the Buddha says, and then this is another important point, that mind is multiple, varied, of different aspects. So there are many, many different types of citta, many different states of mind, depending on what are the factors associated with the mind, what are the roots of the mind. And yet all of the different unwholesome factors of the mind eventually ultimately stem from the three basic unwholesome qualities, that is, lust or greed, hatred, and delusion. And so even though there are many different states of mind, qualities of mind, but the unwholesome actions, unwholesome speech, wrong livelihood originate from a mind which is motivated by either greed or lust, by hatred, by delusion. Okay, so how do these unwholesome habits cease without remainder? How does one overcome unwholesome action, speech, and wrong livelihood? Okay, then the Buddha explains it. Here, a bhikkhu, a monk, but could be not only a monk, he just takes the one case, abandons bodily misconduct and develops good bodily conduct. He abandons verbal misconduct and develops good verbal conduct. He abandons mental misconduct and develops good mental conduct. And he abandons wrong livelihood and he earns a living by right livelihood. Okay, so in the statement we see, in the case of bodily and verbal action, we have two contrasting aspects. One is abandoning the unwholesome side and then developing or cultivating the good or wholesome side. And so this is really just the starting point of self-development, but already you could see that the Buddha's point of view, it's different from that of the wanderer, Ugahamana. And already one could see that it's more commendable. Now, it might be just a little bit of a question comes up about the monk earning his living by a right livelihood. Does this mean that maybe he's working in the goes to the office every morning and works 9 to 5 and then comes back to the monastery. But the expression earn a living, the way it's used in the Pali text, that means how one acquires the basic requisites or supports of life. So how one acquires the things like robes, alms food, a dwelling place, medicines, and other things that one needs. So there are certain types of livelihood, certain ways of acquiring these requisites which are considered not appropriate for a monk, like to deceive others into making offerings, to pretend that he has virtuous qualities so people will want to make offerings to him. The Visuddhimagga has a long list of unwholesome types of livelihood. So if one earns one's living, if a monk gets the means of sustaining himself through offerings of people, that is considered earning his living by right livelihood. Okay, so that is how these unwholesome habits cease without remainder. And then how does one practice the way to the cessation of unwholesome habits? And here we come, this is the standard formula for what is called right effort, which consists in the four great efforts, which is one awakens zeal or desire for the non-arising of unarisen, unwholesome qualities of mind. One makes effort, arouses energy, exerts the mind, and strives. One awakens desire for the abandoning of arisen, evil, unwholesome states. One awakens zeal for the arising of unarisen, wholesome states. And one awakens zeal or desire to maintain the wholesome states that have already arisen. So in other words, we could say right effort, according to this fourfold formula, which is the right effort, it's a way of training the mind to eliminate the unwholesome qualities which will motivate one to perform unwholesome bodily actions, to utter wrong speech, or to engage in wrong livelihood, to eliminate those unwholesome mental qualities, and to develop the wholesome qualities which will enable one to develop or to exercise good bodily conduct, good verbal conduct, and to live by a right livelihood. Okay, so now we could see the importance that the Buddha is placing here on effort, that effort, we'll see, is the key for each of these stages of development that the Buddha will speak of. Okay, so now we come to the next part in the elaboration where we speak about the wholesome habits or wholesome types of behavior. So what are the wholesome types of behavior? Wholesome bodily actions, wholesome verbal actions, and purification of livelihood or right livelihood. Those are the wholesome types of behavior. And what do these wholesome types of behavior originate from? Again, they originate from the mind. And what kind of mind? It's the mind which is not governed by lust or greed, not governed by hatred, not governed by delusion. So that is the origination of wholesome behavior. Now here the question comes, where do these wholesome habits or wholesome types of behavior cease without remainder? And by this passage, I have to say, confess, I'm a little bit puzzled. And before I came here, I wanted to read my friend Venerable Anālayo. He's written a paper comparing the Pali version of the sutta with the Chinese counterpart, I think in the Dzogchen Hanjin, the Madhyama Agama. I wanted to read it before I came here, but just before I came, I found the keyboard on my computer. Something is wrong with it. No, I'm sure it's not a virus put in by that guy. Because I can't even put in my password. Certain keys are not working. I called the Dell computer company, and they said that they will send me a new keyboard. And then I was hoping that we would get here by 6:30 so I could use another computer to check out that paper. But we met several roadblocks on Route 94, and so we had to go up the hill. Why? Somebody came in from that direction?
Yeah, I came from Goshen.
Wow, that's pretty far.
Well, that's where I work.
I see, yeah. So you met those same roadblocks?
Yeah, there was an accident in Florida.
Oh.
And so you had that first detour that took you.
Yeah.
Which way you went? I don't know if you went this way or that way.
We turned off to the right. The first time we turned off to the right, and we went up a hill, winding hill.
Yeah. And then you went up down by the hospital, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
But then we had to turn off, and we went off by the left the next time.
Right.
Yeah. So I didn't even have the time.
That first one was a bear, that first detail.
Yeah, it was very long, very long.
Yeah, there was an accident as well.
Yeah, okay. So this is what's puzzling me here. Okay, their cessation is stated. Here, a monk is virtuous, but he does not identify with his virtue. And he understands, as it actually is, that deliverance of mind, or liberation of mind, and liberation by wisdom, where these wholesome habits or wholesome types of behavior cease without remainder. Okay, there's a note to this. I know what the note says, but you can look at it. Okay, this note is from, I should have put MA, which means it's from the commentary. It says, this passage shows the arahant who maintains virtuous conduct but no longer identifies with his virtue by conceiving it as I and mine. Since his virtuous habits no longer generate karma, they are not describable as wholesome. Now, I'm not sure whether I got that from the commentary or whether I put that in myself, but you have to remember these notes that I put in go back to, I think, 1988. When in those days, I was very innocent and believed that whatever the commentaries say should be trusted, and that the suttas and the Abhidhamma form one completely coherent whole. Whereas now, my understanding, there's a position in the Abhidhamma that the actions of an arahant are not describable as kusala, as wholesome, because the arahant has abandoned all ignorance and craving, and so his actions no longer create karma, which that is correct. But the way the Abhidhamma uses the words, this gets a little technical, the way the Abhidhamma uses the word kusala, and the word kusala, it refers solely to actions and states of mind which create wholesome karma. And so since the arahat is no longer creating karma, in the Abhidhamma scheme, the word kusala doesn't apply to him. But the way I see the suttas now, the suttas continue to use the word kusala, wholesome, in relation to the arhat. And so there's a difference in terminology between the suttas and the Abhidhamma. It doesn't mean that the Abhidhamma is wrong here, but it's just that it's using the word kusala in a more restricted and technical sense, whereas the suttas are using the word kusala in what would be a more ordinary sense, what from the outside we would judge as being worthy, wholesome, good, commendable behavior. Okay, now what struck me is a little bit puzzling. I think I see it, but I don't agree with the commentary that this is describing the arahant. Here, a bhikkhu is virtuous, but he does not identify with his virtue. Okay, the way I would see it, that this is describing the somebody from the stream enterer, level of the stream enterer up, but it would include the stream enterer at the lowest, because he would already know the principle of non-self through direct realization. And so even though he's virtuous, but he doesn't identify with his virtue, thinking, I am virtuous, these virtues are my qualities. Okay, so even though he hasn't completely eliminated, you know, the sense of I and mine, but he doesn't attach these to his virtue. He doesn't take them to be I and mine. And then the phrase, he understands as it actually is that liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom, where these wholesome habits cease without remainder. It seems that this is very specifically tied to a stream enterer, or once returner, non-returner. They understand, pajanati, that liberation of mind, which is the state of arhatship. They understand it, though they haven't yet realized it and entered into it. In the case of the arahant, it would say that having realized by himself with direct knowledge, he enters and dwells in that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. But the stream enterer is one who understands it. He has seen what that state is like, but he hasn't yet eliminated all of the defilements, and so he can't actually enter into it. And so it seems that what the text is saying is that this monk who is a stream enterer, or maybe once returner, non-returner, knows the state where the wholesome habit sees without remainder, but hasn't yet entered into it. But the state where the wholesome habit sees without remainder could probably be that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. Probably because that is signifying a particular type of samadhi entered into by the arhat, in which he's not engaging in any kind of bodily actions, verbal actions, or livelihood. Does that sound too technical, or is it clear? Not completely clear. Is it clear? If it's not clear, raise your hand. Don't be shy. Okay, good, good. Okay. Okay, maybe put it, we'll try to explain it this way. Okay, this box here is that liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom. This would be a special, the way I understand it, a special state of samadhi into which the arhat is able to enter, and which is uniquely accessible to the arhat. Okay, then these are the stream enterer, once returner, non-returner. Now, these three through their attainment, through their spiritual realizations, they're able to see the state. They've seen it somewhat from the distance. It's a little bit like maybe to change the image, traveling to a distant mountain, and then you come over a certain ridge, and in the distance you can see that mountain, but you're not yet at the mountain. But because you've passed over the ridge, which is blocking the view of the mountain, now you can see it. And so through their attainment, the three lower types of disciples are able to see the possibility of that liberation. So they've actually understood, they've understand as it actually is, that deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom, where these wholesome habits cease without remainder, but they're not yet able to enter into it. But the arhat is able to enter. because he has eliminated all of the fetters, all of the bonds or the asavas, so he, the defilements, he can enter into that state. Okay, does that make it clearer? Anybody doesn't understand? Okay. But I wanted to see the Chinese version to see whether there's any. I also didn't get a chance to look at the Chinese version. But we just got here at about 7:05. Okay, where do these... Okay, and then how does he practice the way to the cessation of wholesome habits? Okay, that is developing the right effort factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. Actually, it seems a little bit almost as though this is supporting the Abhidharmic use of the word kusala. Don't you think so? Anyway, don't worry about it. Okay, next we come to what are unwholesome intentions? Okay, so now we come to the three basic forms of unwholesome intention. And what is called intention here, or what is translated as intention, this is the Pali word sankappa. Yeah, the word sankappa, it comes from the root kup, which means the original sense of kup is to make, to shape, to form. And then it has a prefix sam, which gives a sense of together. So sankappa comes to refer to the shaping, forming function of the mind. What we might explain as purpose, motivation, or intention. And then this, what we find in the text, is equated with another word that's very common. That is the word vitakka. Vitakka comes from the root tuk, which takes on the meaning of to think, to reason. And so vitakka is thought, but it's used sometimes in a more limited sense, not just thought in general, but motivated thought or purposeful thought. So these two words come to be treated almost as synonymous in certain contexts. Okay, then we have a standard list of three unwholesome intentions. These are also called wrong intentions. The intention of kama, this is sensual desire or sensual craving. The intention of ill will, that is intending or intention which is associated with hatred towards others, resentment of others, anger towards others, and the intention of cruelty, maybe not so good rendition, the intention of harming others, of inflicting pain on others. It seems there's a close connection between the intention of ill will and the intention of harming, but they're not exactly the same. like one could have ill will towards a person, and that one has resentment against them, or dislike for them, wishing them harm, but one doesn't actually consider taking any action to harm them. Whereas the intention of cruelty or intention of harming is the intention that actually motivates harmful action directed against others. Okay, then comes the origin or the origination of unwholesome intentions. And interestingly, the Buddha says here and elsewhere that intention originates from perception. And what kind of perception? Again, though perception is multiple, varied, of different aspects, but there is perception of sensual desire, or we can say maybe better, perception associated with sensual desire, perception associated with ill will, perception associated with harming. And unwholesome intentions originate from this. Anybody have any idea how the three kinds of unwholesome intentions can originate from these types of perceptions? Any maybe concrete examples from everyday life?
If you perceive somebody with lust.
Yeah.
Then that would lead into the intention. It would underlie the intention.
Yeah.
But the first comes the perception.
Exactly, yeah. Anybody else have any ideas how this could take place? Yeah, that's good. Any other ideas?
Your intention is to do them harm, but instead of them being harmed, they actually benefit. You know, it's like if you intend on switching the lottery ticket, you know, you think they have the winner.
Yeah.
So you switch them, and it turns out that you had the winner all along. You intended to do them harm, but it benefited them. But you've still generated the bad karma because it was your intention to harm them.
Yeah. But the question is, how does the intention arise out of the perception?
Well, the perception would be well.
I think the perception would be, I would say it's occurring at a more elementary level.
Then they have something you don't.
Mm.
They have the winning lottery ticket, they have the benefit.
Yeah. Has anybody ever had the experience? Maybe you're in a room and somebody walks into the room, or it could be even the supermarket if you're shopping, and you don't know this person at all, you've never seen that person, but when they walk into the room, suddenly you feel like an aversion towards that person arise. Well, that would be a more developed kind of perception, I would think, where you actually have, after when they walk in, you look at them, and then you look maybe what kind of coat they're wearing. You don't see much else. What kind of other clothes they're wearing.
If you're driving along and someone cuts you off, you perceive them as an object, as something that is deserving of your cruelty or ill will.
Yeah.
And so because you perceive them as an ignorant person, then you develop the intention to run them off the road.
Yeah. Okay, that's a bit more developed than what I had in mind. I had in mind just a case where there's somebody that hasn't done anything wrong to you, but just walk into the room, you just look at the face, and sometimes one just feels an antagonism or an aversion towards that person. Perhaps one would say that you've had some karmic connection from a previous life, and now it's come to manifestation, to fruition, in a new encounter. Or maybe it's just that they remind you of somebody who treated you meanly in childhood, and you haven't, it's 20 years, you don't even remember that person, but just something triggers some kind of feeling of dislike, aversion. You were going to say something? Yeah.
You have neither wholesome nor unwholesome things. But once you, this gentleman, in fact, you said, once you sort of fix them with some sort of label in your mind, either, they remind me of Uncle Joe, or, they have that coat that I wanted to buy, or whatever, then you now perceive them as something solid to yourself.
Mm.
Yeah. And that then starts to bring up all these intentions of, I want this from them.
Yeah.
I want to go away.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that could happen. Yeah. And then what happens? Suppose you come into the shop. You're maybe at the market buying something. This person comes online. Either he's behind you, you just turn around, and fleetingly you get a glimpse of him, and you feel this aversion come up, this antagonism, but then you think it's nothing, and then you check out from the supermarket, he checks out, then you go back to your apartment, and then you see somebody has moved in just next door, and it's that guy. Then it turns from the perception of ill will, it turns into intention of ill will. What can I do to get him out of that apartment? Okay, so anyway, there are these features in perceptual field that can trigger intentions of desire, sensual desire, ill will, aversion, and even a desire to harm others. Okay, so this is unwholesome intentions originating from perception. Where do these unwholesome intentions cease without remainder? Okay, this is the interesting point. The cessation is stated thus. Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters and dwells in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. It is here that unwholesome intentions cease without remainder. Actually, I would think this is where it gets a little complicated for me too. The troubling phrase here is this expression, cease without remainder. You see, the commentary based upon that phrase takes us to mean, what is the state where unwholesome intentions completely cease so that they could never arise again in the future? And then it explains, 777, that this refers to the first jhana pertaining to the fruit of non-returning, because the non-returner eradicates sensual desire and ill will, and this prevents any future arising of the three unwholesome intentions, those of sensual desire, ill will, and cruelty. See, this is using a scheme of analysis brought in from the Abhidharma, which I don't think one can really find in the suttas themselves, unless one is sort of trying to read that scheme into the text. Do you think that's so, Katrin? You? Excuse me? No, no, no. I was asking whether you think that is the case, that the Abhidharma, because the scheme about paths and fruits occurring at the level of the jhanas.
I find that strange here too.
Yeah. It does. It seems to go against the normal sutta way of speaking, which is just giving a description of the jhanic state, not connecting it with path and fruit. Yeah, perhaps so. Yeah. Perhaps one does find both. I'll have to take a look at this point. Anyway, the way I would understand this passage at a fairly ordinary level, non-technical level, that when one enters into the first jhana, because the mind is solidly established in a state of strong samadhi, in that state, there's no possibility of unwholesome intentions arising. But when somebody comes out of the jhana and goes about the normal activities, then if there is the appropriate stimulus, it could bring up the unwholesome intentions. So I have to say it's a little bit unclear here. And this is why I wish that I was able to compare with the Chinese version. Okay, so how practicing does he practice the way to the cessation of unwholesome intentions? Again, it's through the four factors of right effort. Then we come, what are wholesome intentions? Okay, now we have three wholesome intentions. Three wholesome motivations: the intention of renunciation, the renunciation of sensual desire, the intention of non-ill will, and the intention of non-cruelty or non-harming. These are the wholesome intentions. These form what's called the right intention of the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, where do these wholesome intentions originate from? Okay, they originate from perception. What kind of perception? The perception of renunciation, the perception of non-ill will, the perception of harmlessness. Wholesome intentions originate from this. I guess there would be certain perceptions, perhaps the perception of the asubha, the unattractive nature of the body, the perception of death, that would be basis for arising of perception of renunciation. Then the development of, through the practice of loving kindness, one tries to perceive other beings as being dear and friendly towards oneself. And in that, on the basis of that perception, one abandons the intention of non-ill will. So, for example, when we practice the loving-kindness meditation, we have to work through, firstly, like oneself, the friendly person, respected person, neutral person, until one could even take the hostile person, the aggressive person, and try to see that person as one's own father or mother, brother, sister, son or daughter, and then one begins to get a friendly feeling towards them, and then one will not think any thoughts of ill will towards them. And similarly, if one perceives other beings as being vulnerable to suffering just like oneself, then one develops compassion towards them, and one will not have intentions of cruelty or of harming them. Okay, so this is wholesome intentions arising on the basis of perception. Where do these wholesome intentions cease without remainder? Okay, then their cessation is stated here with the stilling or quieting down of applied and sustained thought. A monk enters and dwells in the second jhana, which has self-confidence, singleness of mind, without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration. It is here that these wholesome intentions cease without remainder. Now, this becomes meaningful from this equation or this synonymity, the sameness of meaning between sankappa, intention, and vitakka, thinking. Because in the second jhana, all applied and sustained thought cease. That means in the second jhana, even the wholesome thought that brought one into the first jhana, that ceases. So there's no applied and sustained thought in the second jhana. And that means that in the second jhana, all intentions, all purposes, even the wholesome intentions, have ceased without remainder. Again, the commentary will connect this to the Abhidhammic scheme of paths and fruits and say that this shows probably the fruit of arhatship based on the second jhana. Yeah. Okay, then what is the way to bring about the cessation of wholesome intentions? Again, it's the fourfold right effort. Okay, so now the Buddha has analyzed these principles, which we could say that this is the Buddha's way of setting up a counterpart to the position of the wanderer Uggahamana. Since the Buddha has shown the different classes or different types of intention and of behavior, and he's shown especially the need for right effort to bring about the abandoning of the unwholesome, the development and transcendence of the wholesome. Now, having set up all of that preparation, now the Buddha can give his own description of the person who he would call the ascetic invisible, the one who's attained the supreme attainment. And then he's going to describe 10 qualities of the arhat, or these are called the 10 factors of the arhat. He possesses the right view of one beyond training, the right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration of one beyond training. And what is called here one beyond training, what is translated as one beyond training, it's the Pali word is asekha. Okay, those at the three lower levels are called sekha, which means those in training. because they're training. They've entered the Noble Eightfold Path. You could say the irreversible Noble Eightfold Path, leading to final liberation. And they're training in accordance with the Noble Eightfold Path to gain the final goal. But the arahat is called usseka, which means literally non-training, non-trainer. Not because he just sits back and reads the newspaper and munches on fruits and candy, but because he has completed the training. He's finished. He's done the work of developing the path. So he's called non-trainer, or one beyond training. And so these, I've mentioned eight qualities that he possesses. They're the same as the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, except for the arahat, they're no longer path factors because he's not developing the path anymore. But these are qualities that he always possesses. So those eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path have been, we could say that they've become fully embodied by the arahat, fully actualized by him. And then beyond those two, those eight qualities, there are two additional ones. One is called right knowledge and right deliverance, or right liberation. So the right knowledge, this would be the full, clear, unobstructed knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. And then through that right knowledge, his mind is liberated from all of the defilements or mental vexations. And so that is his right deliverance, right liberation. And so then the Buddha concludes by saying, when one possesses these 10 qualities, I describe him as accomplished in what is wholesome. You see, the word wholesome is being used here, even for the arahat. Perfected in what is wholesome, an ascetic, invincible, attained to the supreme attainment. And that is the sutta. Okay, if there's any questions, maybe we could take 5-10 minutes. Shiva wasn't here, so he won't. We could sneak in a few more minutes of questions. If any questions, then please feel welcome to us. Yeah, chaitana. Yeah. Yeah. It's a. I found it to be a little bit problematic that English words can float back and forth between the two, whereas in Pali they're quite rigorously separated. Okay, the thing with chaitana, the way I understand chaitana would be, the factor of the mind. Okay, chaitana, I normally translate volition. So chaitana would be that factor of the mind which activates the mind to engage in some kind of action, or even to think thoughts, even the thinking of thoughts, the forming of ideas and plans are functions of chaitana. Sankappa, which is what I translate intention, I think is what gives a particular direction, purpose, or drive to that volition. And usually when we get sankappa in the text, sankappa seems to be used pretty much, let's say it's pretty much confined to these two groups of unwholesome, particular unwholesome types of sankappa, that is the intention of sensual desire, ill will, and harming, and the three wholesome intentions of renunciation or desirelessness, non-ill will, non-harming. Whereas volition can motivate almost any type of bodily and verbal and mental action. It's not confined to specific types the way sankhapa is. Excuse me? I would say chaitanya is more widespread, so that in
arousing or manifestation of the consciousness, action of the consciousness.
Say again?
Action, manifestation of the consciousness.
I said that the chaitanya manifests in the form of action. Yeah. Yeah. The chaitanya is what activates. Chaitanya is what activates certain actions. Or chaitanya is what gets expressed or manifested in actions, bodily, verbal, and mental actions. So that chaitanya is said to occur in every state of consciousness, whereas sankhapa doesn't occur in the jhanic states of consciousness. And probably in certain more elementary types of consciousness.
I know that the sutra begins with, thus it was said, indicating that it was a quotation of Ananda. But then it also mentions the first and second jhanas.
Yeah. I think pretty, I don't have any recordings of the Buddha's teaching, but I would say that they occur so frequently in the text that there's almost no doubt at all that they were quite integral to the Buddha's own teaching.
Okay. I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, if there's no questions, then we'll end for the day. And next Tuesday, we will have the class it's pretty long. It's called the Shorter Discourse to Sakaludai. We'll take the Shorter Discourse to Sakaludai and try to do it all in one class. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, so I'll recite the verses. Akasata chabhumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.